HPPodcast.com.
My friend Lionel Bailey understands the works of Mr. Einstein, and he reads them with the rapt, thrilled attention that more ordinary people give to detective stories. He says they are so exciting that he cannot put them down. They make him late for dinner. It may be owing to this unusual mental conformation of his that he talks about time and space in a manner that is occasionally puzzling, for he thinks of them as something quite different from our accepted notions of them. And tonight, as we sat over my fire, hearing a spring gale of March bugling outside and dashing solid sheets of rain against my window, I had found him very difficult to follow. But, though he thinks in terms which the average man finds unintelligible, he is always ready, though with an effort, to quit the austere heights on which he naturally roams and explain. And his explanations are often so lucid that the average man, I allude to myself, can generally get some idea of what he means. Just now, he had made some extremely cryptic remark about the real dimensions of time and of the palpable incorrectness of our conception of it. But, rightly interpreting the moaning sound with which I received this, he very kindly came to my aid.
I'll do that sometimes. I'll make a moaning sound when I don't understand something. Like, explain to me why I can't hug strangers in an elevator. Could you do that?
People get really uncomfortable when people they don't know... That doesn't sound like you're understanding anything.
I moan when I don't understand it. I like to hug strangers in elevators.
I'm sure you do.
What did we hear there at the top?
We heard the opening paragraph of the prologue from E.F. Benson's The Bed by the Window.
Yes, and who was that delightful reader?
That was none other than your friend and mine, Greg Johnson.
Friend to all.
You know, he can talk to animals.
He can rap with them pretty good, I hear.
Yeah, he's pretty amazing. His affinity is outstanding. I mean, they don't really necessarily understand it, but he could definitely talk to them.
Well, he's just got the guts to do it.
Yeah.
You know, when animals are around, I'm a little bit of a wallflower. So I really admire that Greg will. He'll just go right up and start talking to a goat. He'll just go up and talk to a goat.
He will, yeah.
So this story, it's part of our now furniture-themed month.
Yeah.
And I feel uniquely qualified to address this topic because I don't want to brag, but growing up, my house had a very prominent furniture theme.
It sure did.
And I want to point out that our furniture month, this theme was the brainchild of listener Rafe Ball.
Yeah.
Last week, I was speculating about his identity just based off of his commenting handle. Yeah. And it turns out you know Rafe.
Yes, I know Rafe. I met him at Dragon Meet last year, ran into him again this year. For some reason, my brain didn't connect the two together. I just was Rafe, and seeing his name written down and how I thought it was spelled were different. It just didn't click. I'm sorry, Rafe.
Well, he emailed me. He said, I don't know, one pint of lager and Chris forgets my name. What a lightweight. And then he typed a little winking smiley face emoticon. And I think that's meant to mock you.
I think you're right. And I deserve it because I am a lightweight. I was very tired, and one drink will now put me to bed, basically.
Well, but Rafe's a cool guy.
Yes, he is. He's totally great. Super nice.
He also wrote this comment about the Ambrose Bierce story that we did last week. In the episode, I was talking about how the story influenced a subsequent Japanese story, and Rafe wrote, "When you mentioned that there was a similar story by a Japanese author, I wondered if we were going to get another Edogawa Ranpo situation. What a shame the world was not also graced by Ambrose Bierce." I don't know. Very good. He did a little Japanese.
He did, yeah.
Thank you, Rafe. That was a good joke.
It was very good.
Now, this week's story is about a bed, which might not sound very scary.
Yeah.
I like being in bed.
Me too.
But the UK retailer store out there, the furniture market, they recently did a study in which they analyzed 50 popular horror movies, and they found that whether you're hiding from a killer or a vengeful ghost or a monster, you are far more likely to be killed in bed than anywhere else.
Oh my God, really?
That's right. In the movies, in these 50 horror movies that they analyzed, I'm sure that this wasn't a promotional thing that they were doing. I'm sure that the furniture market is the just commonly doing studies of, of horror movies. But when they analyzed all of these, they ranked each piece of furniture based on the number of times it led to the death of a character versus the number of times it allowed them to survive. And then they came up with a difference.
Okay.
So that's how they did the ranking.
Yeah.
The door, it says the door emerged as the most helpful piece of furniture overall.
Of course.
Having aided 72 people to safety.
That makes sense, yeah.
This despite allowing a total of 50 deaths. But that's weird. Is a door a piece of furniture?
I don't know what else you would call it. What's the definition of furniture? Because it's attached to the wall, but it does something, so it's not really a wall.
Well, bathtubs rank as the second most likely places that you'll die in the horror movies.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously Freddy Krueger likes to kill people in bed, so I think having a bunch of Nightmare on Elm Street movies in this list, which they did in this list of 50, that kind of tips it a bit.
It does.
I was wondering, you know, if they did it about Lovecraft stories, I think the most dangerous piece of furniture would probably be the journal writing desk.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, we've done plenty of E.F. Benson before. If you remember, he was a popular author whose work spanned the 1890s all the way up to the 1930s. Mm-hmm. And we've liked some of his stories, others we didn't care for that much. I think Caterpillars was a good creepy one. I remember liking The Face, I think. But The Man Who Went Too Far, I remember not liking. I think that was the first one we did.
Yeah, I have to say, I don't really remember any of those stories.
Awesome.
Well, no, we just go through these stories so quickly that I dump a bunch of information out of my brain, and then that's it. I'm done. It's like when you do exams at school, how you like study really hard and you know all the facts. And then once you're done with the test, you dump that all that information out and fill it up with other information.
Sure. Well, it's just like last week, Heather was listening to the podcast and I was doing that bit about how people are anal, and she rolled her eyes. She goes, I think you've done that bit before on the show. I said, I'm positive. I'm sure I have. You know, I wish I could keep track, but I don't remember anything I say. This story is cool, and I know that the other stories that he did were kind of more traditional ghost stories. This one toys around with some theories of physics and the nature of time. Mm-hmm. Which I think is pretty cool. That makes it a little more Lovecraftian. So let's just get into it. How do we kick the story off?
The narrator is talking to a physicist friend of his, Lionel Bailey, not to be confused with Lion-O of Thundera.
Oh.
Yeah.
Thanks for clearing that up, man. This whole story seems so weird to me. When I was thinking it was Lion-O.
You're like, is Snarf in this?
Yeah. Well, there was no Snarf. There was no Mumra. I didn't know.
Lionel. See, and every time I read Lionel, I want to say Lion-O.
Well, that's what happened to me.
Lionel is very into Einstein in many of his theories.
And he's not just into them, but he profoundly understands them. And they excite him so much that he devours these theories like detective stories. He'll miss a meal, he'll stay up late to read them. So he's not just one of those guys with the poster with Einstein sticking his tongue out. He also knows the theories, and he can explain them very well.
The theory that is pertinent to this story is the idea that time is an illusion. That all things that were and will be just are. And we perceive it as time, but everything exists at once. Mm-hmm. So the narrator says that they are different, the future and the past. The future may become the past, but the past never becomes the future. To which Lionel replies, the whole of the future is made up of the past. It entirely depends on it. The future consists of nothing else but the past. The narrator tries to change gears and says that the present is the only real thing, to which Lionel says, what is the present? By the time you've said, this is the present, it is slid away into the past. The past has got some sort of real existence, and we know that the future will blossom out of it. But the present hardly can be said to exist at all. For the moment you say that it is here, it has changed. It is far the most elusive part of the phantom, which we call time. It is the door, that is the most that can be said for it, through which the future passes into the past. And somehow, though it scarcely exists, we can see from it into the past and into the future. So the narrator says, thank God we can't see into the future. But then Lionel's like, we can. The future is entirely evolved out of the past. And if we knew everything about the past, we should equally know everything about the future. Everything that happens is merely a fresh link in the chain of unalterable consequences. The little we know about the solar system, for instance, makes it certain that the sun will rise tomorrow. And this ties in with the whole idea that free will is an illusion. Mm-hmm. We are made up of our genetics and our past experiences, neither thing we have any control of. Our choices are already made before we are presented with them.
I think the greatest manifestation of this is when I'm speaking to my wife and she'll cut me off and respond before I finish what I'm saying because she thinks she knows what I'm going to say.
Yeah.
And I'll be like, hey, don't interrupt me. You don't always know where I'm going with things. And she'll say, oh, I'm sorry. What, you know, what were you going to say? And I have to make something up real fast because she was totally right. I wasn't going to tell you to rinse your dish. I was going to say, please rinse your mouth out with excitement because we're moving to Paris. Anything. Anything to prove that she can't predict my behavior. And, you know, here I am now in Paris. I can't speak the language. I'm hemorrhaging money. But, you know, at least I was right.
You were, well, you made her think that she was wrong. And then that was worth it.
But seriously, why does that make... I think that's annoying for anybody when people can predict what you're going to say. You know, why is that so annoying to be predictable?
Yeah, well, I think we all like to think that we're these clever, interesting people and that everything we're saying is important and information that people don't already have. And if people are being able to finish your sentences before you finish them, then that's basically saying, yeah, what you're saying is worthless. So just don't say it.
Well, wow, that's pretty strong. Okay, I guess that is what you get from it emotionally, huh?
Okay, so Lionel goes on to say, I'm sure you know the certainty that we all have now and then that somebody present is about to say some particular definite sentence. A few seconds pass, and then out it comes precisely as we known it would have. That's not so material as mathematical. It's a little instance of a very big thing called clairvoyance.
I disagree that that's not so material and mathematical. I mean, I think he's just engaging in some semantic nonsense.
Yeah.
Because what he's talking about is a reasonable prediction.
Yeah.
But clairvoyance, I mean, if you look it up, that's gaining knowledge of something through extrasensory perception.
Yeah.
And his example is not that, I don't
think. Not at all.
Like, if you can predict what somebody's going to say, it's because you've heard it said before, probably multiple times.
Uh-huh.
And you know the person, so you can predict where they're going.
Yeah.
Like, most people have had that experience where they're watching a movie and they'll say the character's next line before the character says it. That's not clairvoyance. That's because you and the person who wrote that movie have all probably watched the same movies.
Yep.
So there's a certain data set you have in your brain. You know, I'm not clairvoyant because I know what I'm going to eat for dinner tonight. That's just looking at the data and seeing what's more likely.
Exactly.
So I kind of disagree with the premise there.
Yeah. The narrator says that it's just a trick. It's not normal. Lionel disagrees. Everything is normal. Everything depends on some rule. We only call things abnormal when we don't know what that rule is. Then there are mediums. Mediums constantly see into the future. And to some extent, everyone is a medium. We've all had glimpses. So Lionel drops his big theory, which I feel is not based in any kind of reality, but is a fun thing to do in a story. We're all existing in eternity, though, just for the span of our own lifetime, we're also existing in time. But there's eternity outside time. Time is a sort of mist lying around us. Now and then the mist clears, and then, how shall I express anything so simple? We look down on time, like a little speck on an island below us, quite clear, future and past and present, and lawfully small. We get just a glimpse, no more, and then the mist closes round us again. But on those occasions, we can see into the future just as clearly as we could look into the past. And we can see not only those who have passed outside the mist of material phenomenon, whom we call ghosts, but the future or the past of those who are still inside it. They all appear to us then as they are in eternity, where there's neither past nor future. Future ghosts!
That's right. All that gobbledygook leads to one thing, and that's a ghost from the future.
Which you predicted.
Last week you dismissed my ghost of the future theory. Well,
I know.
Look what happened. Maybe it didn't apply to that story, but it certainly applied to this one. The story is about that very topic.
That is amazing.
And actually, so was our that April Fool's Day story that we did.
I was.
Didn't we call it Ghosts of the Future?
We did. We did indeed.
I'm not totally against this theory that he proposes here, though, that if all time happens simultaneously, it's possible that we could get some glimpse into the future.
How?
I don't know how, but as he says, it's just a rule we don't understand yet. So it's possible, maybe, but just not through an understanding that I have.
Yeah, but it's totally just pulled out of thin air. It's like, you know, maybe there are little invisible men that shoot around and they take people out of time and they show them pictures.
Well, you'd be surprised. I read an article about that on Facebook just the other day.
Oh, golly.
It's happening.
The narrator had enough of this talk and goes for another drink. End prologue. So now the narrator wants to get away from it all, and he's got some work to do and in studying. He's one of these kind of rich guys that can just go away for months and work on his little projects and stuff. So he decides he's going to stay at a small fishing village in Norfolk.
The next day after this discussion. Of course, which is so highly related to the events that are about to transpire. He decides to take this trip. And then because he's been, as you say, he's been lazy as all get out in London in the last few months. Too much distraction there. Very typical E.F. Benson character who's spoiled and a little idle. I think that he is doing some sort of writing, or he's supposed to be.
Yeah.
So he comes to this village because in this village, there's nothing else to do. So he'll be able to, he will have to work just to get through the hours of the day. Which sounds nice, actually. I mean, I would like to do that at some point. Rent.
Hell yeah.
Rent someplace remote and just go and get a bunch of work done. Maybe the script I've been working on, my own Evil Furniture film. It's called Feng Slay. The furniture is in just the right place to kill you.
I will buy my tickets immediately.
Fandango's already sold out.
He's going to stay at a house that takes in lodgers. The Hopkins are the people that have the house. Mr. Hopkins used to be a butler and his wife was a cook. Got it on good authority that they keep a tight ship and will stay out of your business. He gets in by train. It's a nice quiet fishing village and Mr. Hopkins picks him up. Mrs. Hopkins takes him up to his room and Mr. Hopkins gets his luggage. He loves the room. It's perfect for him. It's got two beds, one by the fireplace and the other by the window.
Dun, 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 dun. More importantly, there is a waste paper basket, and he says that on that, there is one of those old-fashioned but convenient contrivances which show the day of the month and the day of the week with pegs to adjust them. So it's some kind of calendar device. I had a hard time imagining what this looked like, though.
Yeah, I just thought it was like a pegboard, basically.
Yeah, maybe that's what it is with rings on it or something. I don't know.
Mr. Hopkins then brings in the bags, and Mrs. Hopkins gives Mr. Hopkins the stinkiest of eyes. Full-on loathing.
None more stinky. I hate that thing when you're hanging out with a couple and they really hate each other, but they're faking it.
Yeah.
You know, and you get that side eye, that glimpse of side eye. It can be very uncomfortable. Oh. I've been in some of those situations.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not talking about maybe there was a fight and you showed up at the wrong time because everybody goes through that. But like when it's near the end of something,
yeah.
Nobody knows yet, but you'll get that little taste of it.
Like, oh.
A real profound hatred. There. Yeah. I think he got a glimpse of that.
He settles in fine. He notices that little calendar thing mm-hmm. is set to Tuesday, May 8th. But the actual date is Thursday, March 22nd. He changes the date just to correct it.
Because that date, May 8th, that's in the future.
It is.
And, you know, I know that Benson put this device in here to mark a specific time in the future that the narrator is going to glimpse, as we've set up in this theory.
Right.
But that theory, it kind of said you can just catch a glimpse of the future as if through smoke. It's almost like an ethereal thing. You can get a sensory impression of it. But here, we have a physical device, this calendar, and it's marking what that glimpse is going to show or the date.
Yes.
It's going to be glimpsed, which really doesn't make sense to me, given the rules that have been set up.
No, it does not.
It makes it kind of magic rather than speculative science. So I think that I know why he did it, but I just don't think it quite works.
No, it doesn't fit in with what he has set up earlier in the story. Things are going fine. He has a great meal, gets some reading done.
There was a little detail here that didn't have much to do with the story, but I liked it. It's when Benson is describing the other lodgers. The narrator says, I found that one of my fellow guests was an elderly sepulchral lady with a genteel voice who spoke, but rarely, and then about the weather. She had by her on the table a case of patient's cards and a bottle of medicine. She took a dose of the latter before and after her meal and at once retired to the common sitting room where that night and every night, she played long, sad games of patience.
Hmm.
A minor character, but in describing those few behaviors, a full character. And I had an emotional reaction. I felt bad for the woman.
Yeah.
That she's just there playing solitaire all night, every night. Everything else is very routine and lonely about her life. The other lodger is this scientist who's studying freshwater snails. And he's very excited because he thinks he's discovered a new species and hopes that it'll be named after him. I really love that specificity. These people don't really come into play, but...
No.
They seem like authentic characters.
They do.
I appreciated that.
Then a little later, Mrs. Hopkins barges in to his room and startles the narrator. She's freaked out as well because she wasn't expecting him to be in there. And she explains, when we don't have guests, my husband and I stay in this room. And I just absentmindedly forgot that you were staying with us. So I apologize. And he's like, yeah, okay, sure.
I would feel so bad. That would just wreck everything for me.
You displaced people.
Knowing that I displaced some people, you know, even if I was paying for it, to know that they're like, oh yeah, that's our normal room, but that's fine. We're up in the attic. We like it there with the bats and the insulation,
the dust and the cold
and the demon that lives up there. We're cool with it.
He wakes up the next day feeling a bit off as he didn't sleep well. He had some strange dreams. I'm not sure exactly what happens in his dream, so I'm going to try and explain this, and hopefully you got this out of it. In his dreams, mm-hmm. Mr. Hopkins opens up the blind, and Mr. Dodson had come in to show him his collection of these diamond-shaped fleas that would hatch out on Tuesday, May 8th. Mr. Hopkins is by the window, said that he could hate his wife more intensely in here. And then the blind or something went up, mm-hmm. and it made an explosion-like sound, and then that woke up the narrator. But the whole thing seemed really very real to him.
So it's just sort of a collection of the impressions that he got over the day. You've got the scientist who's discovering animals, and I think the diamonds are some reference to the patient's deck.
Yeah.
From the old lady, and then Mr. Hopkins, something about that date and the aggression he's shown towards his wife, or the bad moment that passed between them, is going to come to bear on that date.
When he wakes up, he notices that the day recorder is set to Tuesday, May 8th. And he knows he changed it, but then he goes, maybe I didn't change it, and I just thought I did. I am confused.
That's the worst when you're trying to remember, did I take that medicine, or did I just realize that I had to take the medicine and say to myself that I needed to do it, but I don't remember if I did it or just told myself to do it.
Right.
Did I kill that guy, or did I just plan to kill that guy?
What?
Ugh, so confused. Which did I do? You know, that moment?
What?
But clearly there's something significant about Tuesday, May 8th. In this story. Let's just focus on the story.
Okay. Days pass. He's getting work done and relaxing. But he gets the feeling, however, that Mr. Hopkins is coming into his room. Now, he's got no proof of this, but it's just a feeling.
And it's not a good feeling.
It feels like Mr. Hopkins is up to something. So he decides he's going to listen in up at the attic, you know, where they're are sleeping, him and Mrs. Hopkins, expecting to hear them bickering or fighting or doing something, but nothing. Again, he's like, I've got no evidence. Everything says everything is fine, but I have this gut feeling that something bad is going to happen and I can't shake it. Mm-hmm. 3 weeks into his stay, he feels like the place is haunted. He doesn't know why again, no evidence, but it feels weird. Like he would be looking into the mirror and then he would see a face in the reflection and then turn around. It was just the light reflecting on the wall. And then when in bed, he thinks he hears some wheezing kind of sound and that there's a man in pajamas bending over the other bed, but it's nothing. And in the morning, he would see Mr. Hopkins in his pajamas and a robe opening the window.
All things that can be explained, although he feels that they're significant somehow, that they're freaking him out. He writes, something was at work, using the trivial sounds and sights for its own ends, kneading away in my brain to make it ready and receptive for the revelation it was preparing for it. So even though everything is explainable, it's meant to seem supernatural because he's being prepared for some kind of supernatural revelation, he thinks or imagines.
So his work is done. It's the end of April, and it's time for him to go back to London.
As he writes the final words on his page, you know, of whatever this is he's working on, and he writes the date, he notices that once again the calendar has been switched to May 8th. He glances back at it a second later, and he sees, no, the date's correct.
Ah.
So I thought in this moment, maybe this refutes what I had said earlier. Maybe it's always been something that's just in his head and it's not actually a physical manifestation. So,
yeah.
So Benson fought back at me. I apologize.
He kind of kicked your ass just there.
It hurts. But I'm gonna buy him a beer and we're all good now.
At the end of this last day, he gets into bed and the last thing he sees before he sleeps is the moonlight on the floor.
I awoke. At any rate, I thought I awoke. The moonlight had broadened to a thick, oblong patch, very bright. The bed beyond it was in shadow, but clearly visible, and I saw that there was someone sleeping there, and there was someone standing at the foot of the bed, a man in striped pajamas. He took a couple of steps across the patch of moonlight, and then, swiftly thrusting his arms forward, he bent over the bed. The figure that lay there moved. The knees shot up, and an arm came out from beneath the coverlet. The bed creaked and shuddered with the struggle that was going on, but the man held tight to what he was grasping. He jumped onto the bed, crushing the knees flat again, and over his shoulder I saw and recognized the face of the woman who lay there. Once she got her neck free from the stranglehold, and I heard a long, straining gasp for breath. Then the man's fingers found their place again. Once more the bed shook, as with the quivering of leaves in a wind, and after that, all was still.
So the man then gets up, wipes his brow, and the narrator realizes that he's sitting up in bed and that actually nothing is there.
Yeah, this was some kind of vision or dream or premonition.
Yeah.
And apparently December is not only furniture themed, but it's also wife strangling month here on the podcast.
Oh, right.
As we like to call it, choke your spouse-ember.
Oh, no.
But this is a very similar thing happened in our story last week.
Yeah, it did. You're absolutely correct. Now we get to the epilogue.
The narrator says that what happened next is known to most people. What he's about to relate is known to most people as the Farmingham murder.
We discover that on May 8th, after the narrator had left, Mrs. Hopkins was murdered. Mr. Hopkins was home, but he had slept in the attic, while Mrs. Hopkins slept in the room. Mr. Hopkins comes downstairs. He sees that the lock on the house was forced open. Then he went to check on his wife and found her dead and strangled. Called the police and the doctor to make sure she was actually dead. They discovered that some money was stolen. When asked why he slept in the attic, he said it was because he knew they were going to have guests in a few days. A few days before they have guests, he just likes to get used to sleeping up in the attic, while his wife always preferred to sleep downstairs.
But there were two weak points in this story. The first was that the woman had been strangled as she lay in bed, full length, with the blankets and sheet over her. But if the supposed burglar had throttled her because she had been awakened by his entrance and threatened to raise the alarm, it seemed incredible that she should have remained lying there with the bedclothes up to her chin. Again, though the drawer into which she had put her money had been forced, it had not been locked. The burglar had only got to pull the handle of it and it would have opened. Hopkins was detained and the house searched, and the missing roll of notes was found in the lining of an old greatcoat of his in the attic. Before he suffered the extreme penalty, he confessed his crime and told the manner of its execution. He had come down from his bedroom, entered his wife's room, and strangled her. He had then forced the front door from outside and, unnecessarily, the drawer where she had put her money. Reading it, I thought of Lionel Bailey's theory and my own experience in the room where the murder was committed.
Well, that's the end of the story.
Yep.
And a correction to something earlier. I think the theme of this month should be amended to come up with a bad alibi to cover up throttling your spouse, Sember. This is the same stupid cover-up story as the last thing as well.
Yeah, somebody broke in and did it.
But this is, I don't know, I thought the story was kind of cool. It took a typical ghost story theme and spun it around where the ghost, it's from the future rather than the past.
Right.
You combined the gothic ghost story with some science speculation, and so it's Lovecraftian in that respect. And we know that Lovecraft was a fan. He wrote the weird short story has fared well of late, an important contributor being the versatile E.F. Benson. He did like Benson quite a bit.
He did like him, yeah.
I mean, if all time is happening simultaneously and time is just a filter through which we perceive it, or if there are many different worlds where different things are happening, it's completely impossible that we could perceive one of the past or the future or another dimension somehow accidentally, and then it would be thought of as a supernatural event.
How?
Well, I don't know how, because we wouldn't know the how, then it would just seem like a supernatural thing, wouldn't it?
But that means any fantastic thing that you come up with could be, well, it's scientific, we just don't understand it. It's possible that a dog could turn into Heather Locklear. It's possible. And if that did happen, it would be supernatural.
Mm.
It's just arbitrary nonsense. It could be anything. And he throws down some science to make you think, oh, we're going to get some scientific stuff. But it's not.
Oh, man. I don't know why I'm so pleased by a dog turning into Heather Locklear.
Because that would be outstanding if that happened, if a dog can turn into Heather Locklear.
Oh, you're right. It would be outstanding. So I was trying to see if there were any furniture-related horror films.
Uh-huh.
The one that came up the most is there's a movie from 1977 called Deathbed, The Bed That Eats. And I know that there's a nasty bed in Hellraiser. I've seen that movie.
Oh, right, yeah.
The bed is kind of where you pour blood on the bed and then the guy starts materializing from it.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Well, the mattress, I think it was specifically.
The mattress, yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty gross stuff. And of course, you were right before about all the Freddy, Nightmare on Elm Street murder things. Those obviously all happen in the bed.
Yeah, but sometimes Jason will fold somebody up in a bed. That's happened a couple of times.
Yeah. Oh, and didn't Kevin Bacon get stabbed with an arrow from underneath his bed?
Yeah, that's right. Went through the bed, got him.
Or the bed company realizes that Hollywood is a propaganda machine trying to make the bed seem unsafe.
Yeah, that's true.
There you go.
I would be really mad if I was a bed or selling beds.
So next week we are doing
The Stalls of Barchester Cathedral, which is about a very active men's room. And the things that, the unholy things that are written within those stalls.
Right.
Yeah, I assume. I haven't read it yet.
You know, that's going to make me want to do research on clever things people have written in bathroom stalls.
That's going to make you want to do research? Now, do you mean you're going to get online and see studies, or you're going to be going to a lot of men's rooms?
I'm
going to
go lots of men's rooms over the next week and just write down whatever I see. So get ready for that on our next episode.
Great.
The Stalls of Barchester or Barstashire. I'm not sure how it's pronounced. Cathedral.
Well, find out. Ask one of those folks out there.
I'll ask one of these English folks around here and they'll tell me.
Yeah. And that's by M.R. James, who is often adapted around the Christmas season.
And that's a thing that's going to happen on this show right before Christmas. That'll be the last show of the year.
Right.
A good riddance to 2016, I say.
I'll say we did some good shows this year.
We did.
Everything else was crap. I want to thank Greg Johnson for being our reader today.
He was outstanding. And I also want to tell folks that he has a new Christmas comedy video out. It features his character, Lunge Dolphin. It's very funny. he picks his top five Christmas films. It's very funny, so go on over to YouTube, look up Greig, G-R-E-I-G, Johnson, and enjoy.
He's an angel among men. And we'll be talking to you all again next week. I am Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast
at hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.